Today is April 27th, 2006. It's approximately 9:25 a.m. We're in the UAW Local 602 conference room. First, we'll introduce the team.
Doug Rademacher.
John Fedewa.
Jerry Smith.
And I'm Cheryl McQuaid. Today, we're interviewing Marlene Stavros. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Marlene, would you state your name and spell your last name for us?
It's Marlene Stavros. My last name is spelled S-T-A-V-R-O-S.
And what is your address?
210 West Fairfield, Lansing, Michigan.
Are you married? Do you have children?
I'm single. I'm divorced. I have two daughters.
And where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised around the Eaton Rapids area, which is about 18 miles from Lansing, south of here.
And your education level?
I graduated out of high school in 1963. Went to work. Well, I shouldn't say I went to work. I was married when I came out of school, out of high school. And had my daughter toward the end of the year, November. And at the time, I wasn't working, but decided to go back to work in 65. So, circumstances. But I worked at the Coca-Cola plant for almost 3.5 years and decided that I wanted something better. So I decided to, I'd heard that GM was hiring, so I decided to stop and put my application in there.
How did you hear they were hiring? Newspaper, friends?
Just word of mouth, some friends that I had. And so I stopped and on my way to work one morning and put my application in and went on to work. And that was on a Thursday. On a Friday, I stopped again and put my application in again. Friday night, I got a call. They asked me if I'd had somebody put my application in for me, and I told them no, I'd been there. Thursday morning, I'd been there Friday morning. I said, I'm going to be back in Monday morning. And so they asked me if I could come in for an interview that night at 7 o'clock, which I did.
So there wasn't a long line to wait in? You just went right in to the front door? Or?
No, there was no line. I just went right in and put my application in. At that time, employment was right down into the main lobby and up the steps, and I believe the Jerry
Brooks.
Yeah, thank you. Jerry Brooks was doing the interviews at that time. And
you didn't say, but I have to ask you this question. Were you ever in the military?
No, I wasn't.
And what did your parents do for a living?
My dad worked at General Motors, 652. When he passed away, he had 10 years in there. He'd worked in a couple different places over there. The last place he was working was in the motor plant. I also had an older brother that worked over there for about 3 years in the motor plant. I'd say he wasn't quite as smart as me because he quit after 3 years.
So we know what you did before you hired in, and you said that they had you come in for an interview at 7 o'clock Friday night.
Yes.
When did you start working?
They asked me if I could start Monday morning. They asked me if I wanted days or nights, and I told them it really didn't matter. I wanted to work. And so he asked me if I could come in on Monday. And I told him I would appreciate it if I could give my other employer a week's notice. And they said that that would be fine, so they set me up for work coming in on night shift a week after that, and which I did. So I came in on October 21st of 1968.
And what was it like? Well, do you remember your first day walking in to go to your first job in the plant? Where was that job?
It was up on the B line. and it was up in Hard Trim. At that time, that was called Hard Trim. I thought it was the biggest plant I'd ever been in. I think I asked directions 3 different times to get up there because it was on the second floor. And I can't really say that the job I had was hard. I mean, I don't know. There was a lot of jobs up there that in Hard Trim that I found out later were harder, but they put me on putting windshield clips on what they call now the vehicle identification tab. I had to put those on, and I had to check the manifest to make sure that there was 2 other clips put on. And at that time, you were supposed to have a 3-day break-in period. And I was on the job for probably about 6 hours, and the gentleman breaking me in left. He said, "You don't need my help." And I picked up things. I mean, when I worked, it was a matter of using your mind and eyes. And I worked with some super people from the time I hired in here. I've always worked with some really good people. People in the department, anybody breaking in, they were good. And you were supposed to be, at that time, your boss, at any time, your boss would go by your work record to know, because I took a pay cut coming in from what I had been making, and it was up to your boss at that time to put you in for your pay raises or whatever. And like I say, the next day the boss came around and he pulled the guy because he said I didn't need him. I was doing fine. When I drawed my first paycheck, I had full pay. I didn't, he had put me in. He said that didn't need to drop or, withhold for that period.
Because you were already a good employee.
Yeah, I was honest. When I come in here, I told him I come in not looking for just a job, I come in to work.
And Doug Rademacher.
Marlene, you said a couple things here. You said you worked for Coca-Cola.
Yes.
Prior to coming in. Had you ever worked in an assembly plant of any sort prior to that?
No.
So would you please share that vision of walking into a place where there's just this continuous line of vehicles and must have been multitudes of people. Can you describe what that felt like to see that?
A little scary. I mean, at Coke, I worked with a group of people, a small group, and we did inspections and things like that, but nothing like when you walk into an auto factory and see a long line. I mean, that's all you see are cars and people. And it was just, I was in awe. I was. I mean, it was amazing to me. And to see the assembly of, everything that went on that people did and worked together to get out a product. And I was amazed. I was just really amazed because I'd never been in an assembly plant this size, this magnitude. I really hadn't.
And you came from a small town. So
right. I had worked in a small factory there, and it was still nothing like walking into Fisher Body. Like I say, I had to ask directions just to get up to the second floor. You got stairways, elevators, but to get up to the second floor and then find the right department. And Once you do that, I found out, though, you can, on your breaks and on lunchtime, you can really explore so that you don't get lost.
Okay. You said you took a pay cut. So why did you come to General Motors and Fisher Body if you knew you were taking a pay cut? What was your drive there?
I didn't like being lied to. When I worked at Coke, I had worked myself from dealing with putting bottles on the line to, I'd done every job there, inspecting, filling, everything. I was on a fork truck. I was driving a fork truck for the last year and a half. And they had a semi-driving position come open. And I applied for it. I was told that I had a very good chance of getting it. I got my, went and applied for my license. And then the man didn't give it to me because I was a woman. They put the guy that was driving before back on, give him another chance. And needless to say, I think it really upset me.
So that was your work. Yeah, I heard you say that your father passed, must have been early.
Yes.
What did your mother do, and how many siblings did you have?
I had a older brother and a younger sister, and our mother had always worked all her life. She was working in what they call Heifetz pickling factory in Eaton Rapids. She worked there for almost 19 years. So everybody in our family pretty much had worked, even back during the war, my folks worked in a factory. They worked what's now known as Horner's Woolen Mills in Eaton Rapids, and they produced gun parts and things for the war. So factory was nothing, you know, to our family. It was, we, you know, they'd always worked in them. They had, my folks had. Like I say, my brother, he also went into Ohl's, but he just didn't stay.
Okay, and one other question I have to ask is, you said it was about 20 miles out of town of Lansing. So what was it like to drive in those days to the job back and forth to Lansing? Did you always travel alone? Did you come to work with a group of people and travel carpool, or what was that like?
No, I usually drove by myself. And it wasn't bad, except in the winter. Highways were a little slick and a lot of snow back then. But always seemed to make it. Later on, I was riding in the 70s. My mother remarried, and I rode with my stepdad. And so, who was also in skilled trades. My stepdad, Milo Campbell, was a jig and fixture man.
In the Fisher plant?
In the Fisher plant. Oh. And so, I rode with him until I could get my car fixed. Then I'd be back driving by myself again.
Okay.
Jerry Smith? Did you always work in the trim department when you were on the line, or did you work in body or paint at all or not?
I never got to work in body or paint. I thought I was going to. When they had the big layoff, I was off for 4 months, laid off for 4 months, and then when I was brought back, I was told I was going to come back into the body shop, which was fine. But then they had a lady on sick leave out of the sealer department, which is part of the paint department. And so they placed me in there, and I was utility in there. And I spent about 6 months in the sealer department and between there and the Bondurite. And the Bondurite was where the bare jobs come through, and you had to a gray substance that you had to put on the seams to seal them before they went in, and you had to, the main sealer put on them by the people in the sealer department. So, and I was only in there about 6 months, and they called me back to trim. So I was in trim, other than that 6 months, I was in trim probably the better part of the little over 10 years before I went into maintenance. And it wasn't that I didn't like trim, I got bored. I had probably done just about every job in the trim department, and I was on repair when they started taking more people into the maintenance department, so I put my application in for tool repair.
Cheryl McCoy. Marlene, how old were you when you hired into Fisher Bedding?
Well, figuring down, I was 24. I was going to be 25 in December of that year. And seemed like the right thing to do at the time. And after all these years, I'm glad I made that decision to come to Fisher Body.
And when you first hired in, you're 24, on the second shift, how many children did you have at home at that time?
Two daughters.
Was that hard for them?
Yes. We basically done a lot. My daughters and I had done everything together. Whether it was a vacation trip, be at home, go get groceries, whatever. We spent, when I was there, I was working days, they knew I was going to be there at night. So this was kind of a new ball game to them. Did I have major problems? No. They were good girls. Yeah. They knew it was a job. I had a good babysitter. And so everything went good.
Excellent. And what kind of, as far as the people that you worked with, how many other women worked around you? Or Hispanics? Or could you tell us a little bit about the culture that you hired into?
I worked in our group with mostly men. The majority of them were guys. There was some other women. The majority of the women at that time were working in the sealer room, in the paint department. We had very few in the trim department. I think that there was, that I know of, there was at least three others. But in our department, it was all men. And I worked, you know, I didn't have a problem with it.
So you never felt as though you were treated differently because you were a woman in
no.
the trim department?
No.
Did you ever have any pranks played on you, or did you play any pranks on any other people? Was there any horseplay going on?
All the time. That's what made the nights go good. You might pick your tool up that you're using for putting a clip on with, and might have gum on it. I mean, they were good pranks. They weren't nothing, you know. Or you might have to look for the tool. I mean, it was just, and it was sometimes, not all the time, but it was sometimes. But yeah, it was nothing. And yeah, after you get used to working here for a while, pranks were played. They were both ways, because it was a way of fitting in. I think the best thing was working on the line, and you looked out for each other. I wasn't on the clip job very long when I went to Spring Detner, and I worked with a gentleman that he was up there in age, but he would have a lot of trouble, and after a while of breathing that stuff, he'd get a nosebleed. Yeah. You tell him, go take care of it. You just, you know, your head was already in the job, you just sprayed both sides. And somebody on the guy working next to him would put the detonator in after I sprayed. And, you know, it worked out. If I got to coughing, needed a drink, he sprayed both sides. His head was in the job. I mean, it was, you really helped each other. And it, you always, I always worked, that's why you always worked with a good group of people. I think as the years went on and there was so many changes, and they ran both lines up there, one line, the A line, one the B. And you was running one on one side and one on the other, and then you had one downstairs for, I mean, the paint department and things were down there before the new paint department went in. So you had two lines running up there. So you've seen a lot of people.
Doug Rademacher.
You say there was two lines. Can you describe, again, we started out and talked about that you hired in and saw that long line of vehicles. Now, that's a line. Right. What was the difference between the two lines? What's this A and B thing that you're talking about?
You had one product, like on the B line, you run the Olds 98 at that time, and then the 88, and then you had a different product. We had a convertible line that we ran, where they had for a while. We had a Vista Cruiser wagon line that also was up there that ran. And so in between you had, you know, this is hard.
Well, I wanted you to describe to people just, you know, the cars weren't the same. There was just all kinds of different responsibilities to each different vehicle, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, you had at that time a lot of offline buildup for the people working on the lines for what they had to put onto each one of the different cars. It was a lot more congested. Back in that year span, because the lines were full, your parts were there, but you might go off your platform across a short aisle of, say, 10 feet, and you've got another assembly line running right there. And the way that they snaked around the curves and then they went back up into what they call the marshalling area in 5 seconds to go over to shipping. The lines were changed for coming up out of body shop. Which at that time I didn't know where body shop was and how they got up there, but I knew that we had them to work on. You know, I mean, so
the place was daunting to imagine the differences of the parts, and one vehicle would come at you, and then the next one might need different parts. And did you ever have a chance where you visited what they called the body shop, and what was it like down there?
I got really, really acquainted with the body shop after I went into maintenance. Our crib was down on the first floor, main aisle, and we serviced even though we were called tool repair and serviced all the tools for the line, we also did quite a number of jobs, because we also serviced automatic drills for the body shop. We had balancers that hung up, that the spot weld guns were hanging on. And so we would go out, if we had a balancer break in the body shop, we would have to go out and change that balancer. We'd have the line down while we were doing that, if it was an on line where the line was moving for safety purposes. And we had areas where there was pits, where you had to go down into the pit, and we also had people working down in there that had air tools, that maybe they put the brackets on for the fender. And so we would go down into the pits. We might adjust automatic drills that drilled the holes for the brackets for the fender. We also would do the ones that had balancers, where they were having to do spot welding on any part of the car. We would be in the pit to make that adjustment with our crank. And so I got well acquainted with the body shop.
Okay. You're right.
You
said you're well acquainted. What I want to get at here is, you'd worked in trim, and that was unbelievable to see the line. What's the picture for this, for whoever listens to us? What's it like to see a body shop? What does that look like?
At that time, it was dirty. And all you seen was a jungle of spot weld guns and people handling those spot weld guns. We had gates, heavy gates that brought parts around to people. Maybe two guys would have to pick up literally the whole side of a car, be the side frame, and place it on, to where then they could spot weld it on. It was nothing like the trim shop. Everybody out there was required to have, you had hats on, you had coveralls, shop coats, steel-toed boots. Trim was always clean. You go in short sleeve shorts, not in a body shop. Body shop, you were well protected from the sparks, because you'd see guys walking around it in the summertime when it was so hot with all these holes that they'd gotten hit with sparks from them spot weld guns and things. And we also at that time had a solder booth where they did all the soldering on all the joints for the cars. And then you had a grind booth. And the things that you had to wear in there was for the ears and whatnot, and your shields for your eyes because of the grinding going on. And we would also have to go in there because we'd have to keep their oilers filled and adjust the balancers also or change one if one broke, for anything in the booths where they were doing any of the grinding. So the body shop probably kept us a lot busier at times than the trim shop for the tool repair group, because of we had floor grinders for maintenance people. We had balancers and grinders and automatic drills for the line people. And there was as many people working in the body shop, I would think, really close as there was in any other department at Fisher Body.
Can I ask you, looking at a job and you saw the person, can you describe the size of a spot welder gun?
They had one called Big Bertha. John, remember Big Bertha?
Yep.
That gun was big. And it didn't matter.
Was it as big as the person?
Oh, it's bigger. And so, you know, it just depended sometimes. When you walked in, you'd be amazed at this person, you know, really manhandling this gun to get it around where it's got to be to spot weld this job. And you wouldn't think, I mean, there was times I didn't think the person could move the gun. The guns were just, and they were on balancers when I come in. I've had some really good partners, and my partner told me that when he came in, they didn't always have balancers on these guns. They literally had to bodily pick them up. And if when they were real heavy, the heavier of the spot weld guns, there would be two of these guys picking them up. And they were steel. I mean, they were solid for spot weld guns. There was nothing light about them. They weren't hollow tubing. They were the shanks and things were solid steel. Which I found out when we had to change a balancer, because we would have to literally lift that gun up off of the balancer, off the hook, and set it on the floor to change the balancer, and then we would have to lift that gun back up and put it back on the balancer hook. So they were very heavy. And then you had others that weren't, but I mean, they probably ranged in, let's say, weight-wise. You had guns that weighed anywhere from probably 30 pounds up to 280 to 300 pounds. And on those large guns, we would have balancers that would take, we would call them a size 30. And they would reach 300 pounds, pick up 300 pounds, and they'd be a three-springer. And those balancers weighed right around 85 pounds. It would take two of us to go up a ladder and change them out, and then to bring them down.
So this balancer was something that assisted the labor, the the worker, to maneuver this tool.
Right. It was hooked on to the spot weld gun so that... He just could reach over and unhook it off his bench, and the weight of that gun would be most of it on that balancer. When it was adjusted properly, then he'd just bring it down and into his, where he had to spot weld.
Now, I want to go a little place. Now, was this job on the assembly line?
Yes.
And how many cars, again, the line runs forever.
Yes.
How many were we running? How many vehicles would run in an hour on average?
Sixty.
So trying to develop a picture.
I'd say, yeah, I would have to say that even back then we were probably running somewhere around 60, 62, 60, possibly 65 jobs an hour.
So one a minute with this huge contraption.
Yeah.
And you'd worked up in trim. You know, people worked their whole lives in body shop, I'm sure, as people stayed in trim their whole lives. So did you gain a respect for this particular group of people that worked in the body shop?
Very much so. Very much so. It was a lot hotter down there to work. A lot heavier, a lot dirtier work. To me, it was even more dangerous because of, you're down there, you're working with raw metal. You're actually assembling the body itself in the body shop. And then by the time it gets to trim, you've got a few parts, the tops of your doors that... are sharp, but nothing like in the body shop. You're literally They were literally working with raw metal. And it putting all the parts on, all the pieces that said would have to be your clips, putting your door panels together, putting the roof on the car. And these people were wearing arm shields, and that's why, you know, they basically had to have the Carhartts or the coveralls, the shop coats, and the arm protections and things on, because they were working to me in the most dangerous part of the plant, and as far as being around the raw metal. And yeah, I had a great respect, because I figured if they called, they needed something, that they needed it now and not yesterday. You know, it's, if one of them balancers got out of adjustment, that's a lot of weight to have to stand there and lift doing, you know, 60 some jobs an hour. You don't want to do it on one, let alone 15 or 20. And so,
was there any women? Was it,
yes,
men? Was it minorities? Who got those jobs? And did they get the pay scale? Was it different than trim?
I don't know. I can't answer the one on the pay scale, because I never ask anybody their pay. I always figured that was their they knew what they got. That was their business. I know welders usually got more in the plant. To me, they should have got more. Rather, I think they did, but I couldn't say for sure in all honesty. There was women. As far as who got put on what job, like the rest of the plant, it went seniority. And if somebody was brought in, new hires, whatever, they were always placed on open jobs in the body shop, just like trim or paint anywhere else. And so I seen some pretty, yes, there was with the women in the body shop, I seen some pretty tough looking gals out there that were on different jobs, and I seen some smaller lady gals out there that, you know, and it, but the one thing that didn't matter, I mean, they could have placed a small built woman on a spot welder. And I'll guarantee you that I never seen a time that if she was having difficulty that there wasn't guys all around her helping. Until she got used to the gun, showed her different ways to use it and do the job. Until she figured out her way of wanting to do it, she always had help.
Yes, Jerry Smith, I was wondering, when you went into maintenance, did you have to go through schooling to learn how to do the tool repair and all that? Or did you just go in and learn from the other people that were already in it?
Probably a good way to answer that question is that I've always been pretty good with my hands. And so most of the things I could tear apart and repair. Yes, I had to take schooling. At that time, we had to take almost 4,000 hours of classes for our schooling. I went to LCC. You could not go during working time. And when I went into maintenance, they put me on days for my, at that time, well, you're called an EIT. And so I worked all day and went home, and then I went to school at night to get my classes. You had to take math, welding, blueprints. There was a variety. That was our requirement for 4 years until we got what they call their S, and which claimed you got your seniority. And after that 4 years, then I was shipped to Knights. And after another 4 years, I made journeyman status. But I found later with the tool repair, you weren't given a card. They were not a card-holding trade. There was some things that I had never seen, and I had a... There was a couple guys in there that was real good that if I had a problem with something, with a larger grinder or whatever, they showed me more or less what I was doing wrong until I could, you know, get it figured out on repairing. Most of the things are you can figure, but you've got some tools that take different size push rods, some take a push rod, some don't. I mean, they're all different. And I think that the worst scenario, and when I went to tool repair, it was so different from working with the people on the line, and not for the better. It's like proving yourself day after day because you're a woman in a man's world. And when they saw that I wasn't lazy, I could do my job, that they, you know, they changed in that respect. But I worked with a lot of older gentlemen that were from the old school. It wasn't good. I had to share a bench, matter of fact, with one of them gentlemen. And he worked afternoons, I worked days. I'd have a tool tore apart. Well, when you got a call come in to go out and do a troubleshooting, you just left everything on the bench and you went out and did your troubleshooting. And most of you know that when second shift starts, they usually come in at, you have a half hour to, you know, they start at 3 o'clock. So you have, you know, you should have everything picked up. Well, this gentleman, they started at 3:30. This gentleman would come in, and I would find everything that I had been working on that day shoved up in a little corner. Parts, tools, rags, everything. After the third day of that, coming back in from trouble, because we had a lot of trouble calls. And I did that for about 3 days. And I come in and I got all my stuff off the bench. And I took all of his stuff and scooted it right up in that corner where mine had been. And when he got mad at me, I got in his face so bad that I told him he could either come in at his own, you know, at the right time, or just go sit at another bench till I got back to clean up my stuff. But don't ever touch it again. It was just the way it had to be. This guy did not like, I'm sorry, he did not like women in trades. So that made it made it pretty rough there. It was bad enough that first year I was ready to go back to the line. I had some wonderful people out there that I'd worked with. I had never worked with something like I'd been into there for that period of time. And it kind of settled out. And after that, I didn't think anymore. I didn't really have any more trouble with the guys in the tool repair. They were a pretty good bunch of guys after that.
Let them know where you stood.
Yeah. Well, I think when they found out that I could do the work, I held my own. I didn't expect somebody else to do my job and get my pay. And I never have. So, I think as I got a respect for them more, they got more of a respect for me. And but there were still times. And even in maintenance, that the management would try to overlook a woman when it come time for that job switch or something different to happen. In our group, it was like the window job. When the seniority person retired, the next person in line on that shift would take that job. And it had always been that way from day one that I'd gone in there, and I was told that it had always been that way. And when I was on second shift, and our window man was going to retire, the next man in line said he did not want it. Well, that put me in line for it. And sorry to say, I had somebody from management tell me that they didn't have to put me on that window job, that they could put the lowest EIT person in there on it if they wanted to. And it kind of hurt because I had already gone through all the training for the computer and everything. So, and I was always up helping anybody with if they were on break or whatever. You just kind of helped each other because it was a small group doing a lot of jobs. And so you always helped do whatever. If somebody come in needing something, you fixed their tool and sent them back to the line. We had a lot of people come in. They had certain ones that they liked in there to work on their stuff. They'd bring it right into our crib, go right to the person's bench, whoever it was, and they'd fix it and give it back to them. The only thing I didn't like was if somebody out on the line tried to repair their own. And then it might take a couple days for them to get it back. You don't want to do it again. Because the main thing was they'd lose parts. If we didn't have them, it took a little longer. Even if we had them, it took a little longer if they had torn apart. Quick lessons. You know, but it worked out. So there was still, even though in there it was a close knit, there was still a lot of problems with management doing what they're doing.
Did it work out that you ended up getting a job? Or
No, I didn't get it.
Just because management didn't want a woman in there.
Exactly. Yep. And so I stayed on the bench. I did trouble calls. I still helped out if the guy needed help on the window. The guy that they actually put the guy on there that didn't want it. And so he would do bench work, and when he was off, you know, break or whatever, I'd go up and help, you know, I'd do the window for him. He didn't like running the computer. And I knew that. So when it got time to put all the parts that we'd used and ordering, I just go up and do the computer work for him. They didn't know the wiser. They thought he'd done it. No biggie.
Cheryl McCoy. Marlene, what is one of your best memories of Fisher Body?
That'd be hard because I've got a lot of good ones. And I think my best memory was when I was a production worker on the lines, working with a group up in hardware trim, putting in regulators.
You put in regulators.
Mm-hmm.
That was a rough job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those were the heavy ones. You put bolts in them. You didn't put rivets in them. You put bolts in them. And we would switch around up there. I mean, you'd have had to been in our group because we would literally, we could do either side of the line. We would switch. I mean, we'd do our job for an hour, and then we'd switch side to side, and then we'd switch with the people on the front. There was four people at that time done regulators. And it was a lot of fun. We joked around a lot, and the only thing our boss told us, don't ship nothing. Because you're going to be down there picking it up. and we didn't. Matter of fact, we did our own, we did repair. If somebody behind got behind us, why, we had a screw gun there as well as our gun for the bolts. And so we would take and just, you know, we might do a couple screws and a feather for them, you know, to get them caught back up. Because we did feathers, we did feather guards, we did regulators. And I think the thing I like too is, you know, and but that was my best. The people and in hard trim, I liked working with production people. I liked working with people, period. If our line went down early and the other line was still running, and it, I'd go over to the A line, which was called the A line back then, which eventually became the C line, I believe. I'd go over and set windshields and bed glass. They'd have somebody want to go home in 8 hours. You'd go over there. That was the nice thing, too, about working in trim or working with production. You could work overtime. And so it was, it helped.
Marlene, I know that we could get a lot more out of you, but we need to close up this interview. And is there anything you want to share with us before we stop the interview?
The only thing that I spent a lot of times on night shift, and the only thing that I would ever do different is and tell the people that anybody that has children growing up and they're on second shift, if there's any way that they can possibly go to a midnight shift or a day shift while their kids are being raised, do it. I have two wonderful daughters, and I've got three wonderful grandchildren. But I think it got harder on them as they got older. Me, because I could not get on any other shift. I literally was stuck on second shift all the time they were growing up. And to answer a real quick question that you'd asked me earlier, as they got older and they had programs in school, I had some wonderful bosses too that would let me, you know, get out to go to those programs and come back, or I could just put in for the half a night or whatever. But that was a biggie with me. I wished it at that time, that's probably the only time that I wished I could change. But they're still good. They got a wonderful job. So, you know, it does work out in the end, but you miss a lot. And I think that, you know, they need things, whether it's supervision or help with things, more in the afternoon and the night period than they do it, though, you know, during the day. So.
Well, Marlene, thank you very much.
We really thank you very much. And if you have the time, we'd like to do another interview with you and continue this on.
Yes, and congratulations for being a woman in trades and that you've stuck it out and stayed with it.
So. Thank you.
I think that was my dad always said, don't go into a shop, you'll never make it. And I wished he was here to see that I had almost 38 years.
38? Wow.
It'd be October.
Congratulations.
It would be 38.
Yeah. So. We think you've done great. So.
Thank you.
Enjoy.
Thank you.